Hello everyone and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you should know that we typically talk about everything through this week's episode, all the plot details. We spoil everything through this week's episode. But we don't spoil anything from future week's episodes of Game of Thrones. That includes anything on the next time on preview that HBO likes to air with Game of Thrones. This week, we'll be talking about everything through Season 4, Episode 6 of Game of Thrones. Is that right?
He says incredulously, yes.
I can't believe we only have 4.5 more of these to do, Jonah Robinson. Plus our bonus episode with the Kickstarter backer. But anyway, this week we'll be spoiling everything through The Laws of Gods and Men, Season 4, Episode 6, written by Brian Cogman, who joined us for the previous episode. You guys will already have had that interview available to download, so we really appreciate him joining us for that. He did not stick around for us to ruthlessly tear apart the episode on the show. I'm just joking. I really like this episode, but we will have some things to say. You can find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. A Cast of Kings is also where you'll find us on Facebook and Twitter. So because we just recorded that episode with Brian, this episode will be a little bit shorter today. But we hope you guys enjoy the bonus content anyway. Now, Joanna Robinson, before we get started today, we gotta confront the elephant in the room here, which is that, you know, I've done the math, Joanna Robinson, and I think somewhere between zero and 0.1% of the people that watch Game of Thrones on a weekly basis listen to this podcast. Did you know that?
Wow, no. Okay.
That is a huge amount. No, it's actually, obviously 0.1% is not that much. But we actually have been getting a lot of downloads this week, which makes your horrible audio quality completely inexcusable, Jonah Robinson.
I mean, it's reprehensible, really.
You've been using a laptop microphone, I think, for a lot of time. Is that right?
For this particular season, we've been having some technical difficulties, so we were making do.
You may have noticed that Jonah's audio sounds a lot better, that her melodious voice sounds even better this episode.
Thank you.
And that's because the awesome people at Rode Microphones heard how terrible the audio sounded and were like, guys, we got to help you out here. I know there's a lot of podcasters who listen to this show, and a lot of people have asked me over the years, like, what microphone should I get? And so the people at Rode Mics hooked you up with a Rode microphone podcaster's kit, I believe, right? It comes with a boom arm and the shock mount. The microphone.
It is the fanciest freaking thing I've ever seen.
And the thing is, I got one of these a few years ago, and it is awesome. I've used it ever since. Because it has this boom arm that you can like position, you know, no more like leaning awkwardly over your desk trying to talk into the mic. It has this boom arm you can keep out of the way, you can be comfortable, and the audio quality is great. I mean, decide for yourselves. You can decide for yourselves, listeners, after listening to this episode.
Yeah, just listen to my voice. I used to have to hunch over. Now I get to sit up like a human being. It's
there
very
you
nice.
Go. You can even stand. That's how awesome this
podcast is. I can do whatever I wanted.
You can do whatever you want. Anyway, you can get that Rode Podcasters kit anywhere, like on Amazon, bnh.com. But I think it's a dramatic improvement. I no longer need to feel like I'm clawing out my ears every single week.
I see how it is, Dave.
Nails on a chalkboard is what
I
you
see
sound
how it
about.
Is.
Yeah.
I see.
So that goes away now, fortunately. So. Anyway, thanks to Rode Microphones for hooking John
up. Thank you so much.
And yeah. Thanks also. Just check it out. It's the Rode Podcasters broadcast kit. It's about like $300, but it is well worth it. It's the last podcaster mic you'll ever need to buy. So as opposed to all the ones that I've bought over the years that now sit unused.
That's true. I've got one like sitting on my desk, sort of sadly collecting dust right now.
Yeah, I have like four. Wait, you do? Why haven't you been using it, John Robinson?
The cable was, but we don't need to go into this.
Anyway, I have like four podcaster microphones that I bought over the years that I just don't use anymore. But the Rode one is the one I still use. So anyway, but let's get on with the show, John Robinson. You have some quotes here in the show notes. You want to go over those first or later?
Oh, sure. These are just pulled actually from our special guest Brian Cogman did an interview with Entertainment Weekly, and these were two sort of pertinent quotes I thought for the episode. One was just he's addressing the pacing of both this episode and some of the other ones we've seen this season, which is that's something we're trying to do more this year, less cutting back and forth through a lot of places, do more quality versus quantity. So I think in the past we've complained that there are so many characters in the show just cut, and you get just a couple minutes with each one. And so now they're trying to parcel them out over different episodes. And so you'll notice in this episode, we start with, you know, Davos, and then we move, you know, et cetera, and we just stay in that place until that plot is wrapped, and then we move on. So instead of the cutting back and forth. And then the other thing he said was, and another thing, this is the first Thrones episode in our entire run that doesn't feature a Stark. It illustrates that the principal family of the show, in a way, has become the Lannisters. So I just think those are two interesting, like, structural and thematic thoughts to have in your brain as we talk about this episode. So.
Yeah, and I for one think it's a dramatic improvement in terms of like how they pace the show, right? Rather than bouncing around to eight plot lines in one episode, you really the scenes get a chance to breathe. And certainly in this episode, there is a massive courtroom scene that is probably one of the finest scenes in the show's history. And really, they took their time with it, and it was. You know, I think the results are much better as we can see. So, anyway, let's dive into the episode. Actually, no, you know, General Robinson, I had a email I wanted to read, that one from that gentleman who's talking about English.
Oh, exactly what you wanted to. Oh, yeah.
And the common tongue and so on.
Uh-huh.
But let's get to that at the end. Let's try putting the emails at the end this week.
All right.
Because we tend to go into a lot of emails at the beginning. So let's get into that at the end. We start this week with Stannis and Davos, who are on a ship, and they go and they visit Braavos. And this is the first time we've seen Braavos in the show, right? Like we saw it in the opening credit. I think my companion, who I watched the show with, she kind of freaked out when we saw Braavos, because it's the first time we've seen like a new location this season, other than Meereen, right? Which we were introduced to early on. So we saw Braavos, and it's like a pretty spectacular shot. I have to say, like, some of the CG I haven't been a fan of this season, but it starts in close, and then the camera like kind of goes back outward until you see like the breadth of like what this city is like.
Right.
And I thought it was pretty impressive. You as a book reader, you probably had Braavos imagined somewhere in your mind, like based on reading it, like you probably thought it would look like something. Did this live up to your expectations?
I thought that, well, you know, I cheated a little in that they had that shot of the Titan of Braavos in like one of the trailers for the year, which is why you, Dave, usually don't watch a lot of the trailers. So I was spoiled for that shot. I knew
How
it was coming.
How dare you violate the rules of the show, Joanna?
Pre-season trailers are on the table. It's the next time on that we have to worry about, right?
Right.
Anyway, yeah, so I knew the Titan of Braavos was coming. And I had also seen some sort of fuzzy shots of the actual, you know, the bankers. But it was beautiful. I thought it was breathtaking. I too, also do not really enjoy CG that much. But, you know, just even the shots of the sails of the ship, like the, you know, the stag on the flaming heart. I mean, it was just, it was beautiful. I was really excited for it. So,
I did think it was a bit weird that they have you sail underneath, like, the legs of the Titan, who's wearing kind of a skirt-like thing. But whatever.
I don't get what you're insinuating, Dave.
Nothing.
But yeah, it's their defense. It's sort of like the Bloody Gate at the Erie. You know, like they force you to go through this very narrow inlet to the lagoon, and it's part of their defense system at Braavos.
Gotcha. So it serves a plot purpose then. There you go. All right.
Not just for salacious, you know, what have
just
you.
So you can catch a quick glance upwards.
No.
When you're sailing underneath. So they get to the Arryn Bank, which is not something that – it's something that like they've been mentioning forever. And they've been building it up for, like, years and years. And we finally see it. And I have to say, Joanna Robinson, I do feel like what we see delivers on kind of what I had imagined in my mind. Like, we have these associations. Like, it's kind of this monolithic, dispassionate organization.
Yeah, austere. Yeah.
And it was awesome. And it has that gentleman, the actor from Sherlock as well.
Mark Gatiss.
Right.
Yeah.
Who plays Sherlock's brother in that show.
Right. And he's a Sherlock writer too. Like Mark Gatiss is this crazy, I don't understand how he has time to do anything because he also writes for Doctor Who. Like he has his fingers in, you know, all these pies. He was on stage with Tom Hiddleston, Coriolanus. Like Mark Gatiss is the icon of like Anglophilia geekitude. And of course he's going to be in Game of Thrones and
yes.
They cast him perfectly in this role. Not only does the writing deliver and the set deliver, but I think putting Mark Gatiss in that role was huge to making that scene really work so well. So
definitely, totally agree. And the function of the scene is essentially to have Stannis kind of lose his plea in front of the Iron Bank, but then Davos come in and make a pretty freaking good case for Stannis.
Right.
I guess the net of it is that...
Well, they got a loan. Because when Davos goes to see Salador, he has, like, all that money in a wallet and said, like, a whole chest
right.
of it.
In those little, like... I don't even know what you described.
They were
as.
Amazing. I want that. I don't know what it is either. Like, it looks almost like a really fancy version of, like, what coin changers would have on their belt in the
right.
bus.
Right.
But, like, yeah, it was beautiful. Whatever that set, that prop is, I want it.
You know what it reminds me of, Jonah? When I keep my when I have a lot of change to go through tolls, I keep them in mini M&M containers.
I mean, yeah, it's basically the Bravosi version of a mini M&M.
Of a mini M&M container. That's right. That's right. Except it has slots and stuff. But but the point being, they got the loan. Davos did a kick-ass job presenting the case, and we got to see Salador again, who. Was an awesome presence like the two times we saw him previously, and I'm wondering like where like I guess I feel like you don't introduce a character that awesome and then not have him come back in a major way. So I was glad to see him return in this episode. Any other?
And
thoughts?
I guess it sort of addresses that question mark of virility of non-white characters on the show. I know, like handily in one bathtub scene, I guess. So yeah.
Yes, that was it. For those who have no idea what Joanna was talking about just now, there was a question in an email last week, right, about
right.
The people of color in the show not being virile because the one that we know is doesn't have a penis. But as a matter of fact, Salador is here, and also I think it was also pointed out that Oberyn Martell is a person of color
and
as well.
And Khal Drogo, yes.
And Khal Drogo, right. So
this is like flashback to when I got all those penis emails when I made that claim a couple seasons ago that like we hadn't seen any full frontal male nudity, and then I got an inbox full of penis photos.
Penises, many of which are from Game of Thrones. So
okay, we can move on from this. Sorry.
Yeah. So anyway... So cool scene with cool scene at the Iron Bank of Braavos. I was a fan. Any other thoughts about this plotline before we move on, Joanna?
I just hope everyone was playing the drinking game and chugging the entire time that was happening.
All right. So cut to Yara, who we haven't seen for like five episodes. I don't think she's even appeared this year, right?
Right.
This is the first we've seen of her since last year. And so we've seen some of Theon, obviously, but this is the first we see of Yara. And there's this kind of intercutting between Yara giving what I thought was actually quite a rousing speech and Ramsay having sex. And
that was one of the most oddest. Like, I have some thoughts about it, some spoilery thoughts we can get back to later, some episodes from now. But
in future episodes of A Cast of Kings, you're saying?
Right. But just taking it as face value, it was one of the most awkward bits of sex position. If they were thinking, we cannot have Yara, who is somewhat plain of face and austerely dressed, read this note, give this rousing speech, we must, like, put some naked lady on top of it. I mean, you know. I don't know.
That is a very uncharitable reading of the scene, I would say.
Okay.
and also, wow, slamming Yara's looks. Come on, Joanna Robinson. But I guess...
I'm just saying she doesn't have to gussy herself up because she's badass no matter what. I don't know. I'm just getting further into trouble here.
I guess... Okay. I agree with you that it was weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
I agree that, like, the reason they're doing this intercutting doesn't... it's not apparent. Immediately obvious to me.
Right.
Right. But I think that, like, if I had to explain it, if I had a gun to my head and I had to explain it, I would say it's because Yara is giving this whole talk about how Ramsay has, like, violated the Greyjoy line by castrating. Like, she's actually telling everyone about the castration. And actually read the line to everyone about the toy and stuff. So she's talking about how, like, Ramsay has compromised Theon's virility, which is a term I think we're going to try to use as many times in this episode as possible.
Right, that's your new drinking game.
yeah, that's right. compromise Theon's virility and the show is juxtaposing it with Ramsay's virility, I guess. Because he's having sex with someone.
Get it. maybe.
That's all I got.
Possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, why else? I'm just trying to rack my brain as to why else they would show that.
But it should be noted that that's Miranda, who we did see, like, I don't know, shoot another girl or at least help suck a dog on her earlier this season. So,
why?
You know, at least Ramsay's being faithful to his bed warmer. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, they have this huge talk, and then she gives this huge speech, which I actually thought was very effective. And I was really into it. I was like, yeah, these guys are going to take out those Boltons. And then, like, 5 minutes later, the scene is over. And it ends with Yara being like, well, I'm out of here. Peace. What I did like about this scene was I thought Alfie Allen's performance as Theon was really convincing. And actually, the more time that passes, like, kind of the more I feel like I was wrong to be so down on the Theon plotline last season.
Right. Because you, like we talked about, you really need to have seen that in order to understand where he is right now.
I mean, I guess what I would say, the thing that I still kind of wish is that we saw a lot of just torture and then only a little bit of kind of brainwashing towards the end. And
so a lot of physical torture rather than the psychological torture.
There was some psychological torture, like the idea of him, and I guess here, like, we see that. Okay, here's a question, right? That there's a scene last season where Theon thinks he's escaped.
Right.
And then it's revealed that he didn't escape.
Right. Right.
So would the scene where they try to bust him out have been as effective in this in this episode if we hadn't seen that last season?
Right, and I don't think it would have.
Yeah, I don't think it would have. And so that ultimately, I feel like, justifies what they did, like, at least a huge part of what they did last season.
And I mean, like, I don't want to get too far into it, but I think it's also a problem that we have. You know, I have, like, a slight smug edge as a book reader, but, you know, as they go further and further off the map, you know, there are going to be further and further questions. So it's just maybe a slight problematic nature of examining a TV show on an episode by episode basis.
Yeah.
Or if not problematic, at least, you know, you and I, as we try to be, need to be willing to reassess our earlier opinions in light of developments.
For sure.
So, yeah.
For sure. I mean, if we say that we can't evaluate each episode as its own self-contained, you know, entity, then there's basically no point in having this podcast at all. Right.
Right. And so, yeah, exactly. I'm not saying that it's useless. I'm just saying, I think, I just think it's worthwhile to re-examine or revisit certain
thoughts. Yeah. And I think we try as often as possible to do that on this podcast. So, and I'm totally saying, I was wrong. Like, viewed in light of that, this completely, like, the developments that we saw last season are much more understandable.
Right.
Because you see him, like, you know, imagine, like, we didn't have any of that context. Like, it would probably be baffling why he was resisting being broken out.
Right.
Right. And so, yeah, I thought that scene was really effective. But then it ends really suddenly and anticlimactically, like Ramsay essentially saying, looking like a badass with blood all over him, and essentially saying, you know, I'm about to release these dogs who are going to rip you to shreds. You better get out of here. And as Brian Cogman pointed out, it's not because she's afraid of the dogs. It's because what benefit is there to staying and fighting the dogs, right?
Right. If Theon doesn't even want to go with her.
Yeah.
And what I would question, like Brian did a really good job of explaining it, if you listened to that interview that we did with him. But what I would question is whether or not the show did a good job of conveying his intention. Like, his intention makes sense to me, but I'm not sure that anyone watching the episode really got that from it.
Yeah.
And even I forgot for a second what Ramsay's dogs are capable of. I think some people are like, oh, just a couple dogs. But, you know, we need to remember what we saw in episode one, which is those dogs tearing a girl limb from limb. So maybe if we had seen one of those dogs go out, I mean, I guess, as Brian said, the point is not that she's scared of the dogs. But still, if we had seen one of those dogs tear apart one of her Ironborn men,
right,
then maybe
it would have
that
made
would
the connection a yeah. little bit better.
Right. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to Monday evening quarterback this.
Let's actually return to that point later on when we get to emails, because
okay.
we got a lot of emails about a mistake we made last week, Jenna Robinson. I don't know if you recall.
We never make any mistakes, so I don't know.
So anyway, let's move on. We got to visit Dany this week. Oh, actually, wait, before we move on, yeah, overall, like, what did you think of this whole Yara scene, Jenna Robinson? Like, I think some of it is off book, if not all of it, right? What are your thoughts?
Oh, it's 100% off book. And so when at the end of last season, she's like, I'm going to take some of the Ironborn men and go rescue my brother. And all the book readers are like, what?
That is an amazing Yara impression, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, and so we're all like, what? But it's like the Craster's Keep thing where, okay, so once you accept that they're going to do this whole mission that's off book, then you have to look at the net positives. Or, you know, because they're not stupid. They're not just going to throw something in there for no reason. So what was their intention? And I think what we really got was some great character stuff from Theon. I mean, we saw it in the first, you know, couple scenes that we've had with him this season. But just to see the extent of his damage, where even when his sister is there offering him his freedom, he has fully embraced this new persona. And the follow-up scene with Ramsay and Theon in the bathtub, like, I just – that is the positive I'll take away from it. And also – I'll talk about my other thoughts on it later on.
There was a chilling moment in that scene when Ramsay asks him if Reek loves him.
Yeah. Right?
And he says yes. And what's great about that performance is, like, I feel like there's a little bit of ambiguity there, right? That you can interpret it as he actually believes that he loves him, or you can interpret it that he's just saying it because he's been programmed to say it.
Right.
So I really appreciate how Alfie Allen is playing it. I think he's doing an amazing job here. But Jonah Robinson, it almost makes it sound like we need to introduce some new spoiler rules for the podcast. Like, if people are going on a mission and it's not in the books, it's not going to succeed, I think it's not going to succeed in the way that we hope it will. Put it that way. If I'm taking,
I guess that the net result is going to be that all the people are going to go back to where they started.
Right.
But I'm not sure that that's true, because who knows with the show how much further off book they're going to go, and if they're just getting their feet wet with these, you know, off book missions, and soon like the outcomes will be different. But yeah, I mean, I think I did at least keep it under wraps that Yara's thing was not in the book. I was a little more vocal about the Craster's Keep stuff. But yeah, no, I think that's a good point, that I shouldn't say something isn't in the books, because then you guys will know that nothing's going to happen.
That nothing of significance will change. Well, no, right. I'm being facetious, because as you pointed out, there is character development that does happen, right?
Right.
It just is like the big plots of the story aren't going to move forward in a huge way.
Right. Yara gets back on her boat. Theon stays with Ramsay. John goes back to the wall. You know, Bran and Jojen and Mira, Hodor keep going north.
Right.
Like, all the pieces go back. They reset.
Right.
Basically, but we do learn things about the characters as they go through it. So
it's not really that much of a spoiler, just because I don't even know what it's supposed to be. Right. Maybe that. You know what I mean? Like. Yeah. Anyway, it's just interesting.
Right, you don't know where the pieces are supposed to be.
Exactly. So yeah. Like, it's like, maybe this is the way the book meant it. Like, I just have no idea. You know, so I don't think it's that big of a deal. I was just kind of being a little facetious there. It is interesting to think about, though. Like,
right, absolutely.
When a show deviates from the book so far. So, all right. So we got to visit Dany this week, and here we are finally seeing a little bit of. I will admit, Jonah Robinson, I have been frustrated in the past by how black and white Dani sees the world. And how absolutist she is about, this is right, this is wrong, we're doing this, we're doing this. And I know that's an unpopular opinion to be frustrated by that. But because everyone just loves Dani, and I love Dani, like seeing her kick ass and stuff, that's awesome. But it is, she's very, black and white, and like, this is right, this is wrong, and there's no in between. And I like this scene because it kind of introduces this idea that, yeah, hey, guess what? There is some gray area in the world. Like, there is some in between in the world, right?
Right. And I think we tried to talk about that a little bit, sort of like with her treatment of her servant in Karth, we even did talk about it, I think, when nailing the masters up. And Marine is sort of, she said, I'll meet injustice with justice. But, I think we have to side with Barristan Selmy here. Like, this was a rash decision. She didn't judge those masters. She just nailed them. And what I liked about this character, Hisdar, and what he said is he didn't try to defend the masters at all.
Yeah. He just avoided that topic completely. Yeah,
but he, which I guess is like a slippery political thing to do. But he put a face on that for her, and she's right to push back a little and say like, "What about those children?" And he's like, "Yeah, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about my dad, who you super murdered. So can I get his body, please?" Right. I thought it was a great scene. I really loved it.
Yeah, it was really good. Well done. And the throne room also, I thought, looked spectacular. I mean, there's a story in the Bible of like King Solomon, right? And how he has this gigantic palace and stuff. And then there's a story, like this proverb of like how there's these two moms and they're both convinced that they're the mother of this child. And he's like, well, split the child in half, right? And then one of the moms is like, no, don't do it. The other mom can have her. And then Solomon gives the baby to the mom that says that, because that's the real mom who really loves her. And he's like, you can just imagine like this king or queen or whatever making all these important decisions. That scene with Dani in the throne room is kind of like what I imagine when I think of someone doing that. Not the Iron Throne, but like something like that. Do you know?
Yeah, like King Solomon had to like hobble up a bunch of steps before he could like offer out his wise proclamations.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
I just think it looks spectacular.
I agree. Yeah. And I'll give you biblical.
Yeah. So,
some real Old Testament stuff for sure.
So that is all that's going on there. And then I kind of like this scene where she's like, how many are there today? 212. Wow, that's a lot. Because it was like, wow, that was an awkward one. She was like walking on air after giving that guy a bunch of money for his destroyed cattle. And then, wow, had to face a really terrible one. Speaking of which, a lot of people were asking, what happened to Dany's dragons last week? And I think we got our answer this week, which is that they are they're not being controlled very well, right? I think that's what we're supposed to take from this episode.
They are learning how to barbecue, I guess. This is a good week for CGI, right? We talked about the Titan of Braavos already and this shot of the dragon, Drogon, I think, was probably the best dragon shot. Once again, spoiled for me in the preview for the season, but I think the best dragon shot. Brian Cogman said elsewhere that they wanted it to come up like a helicopter coming out of a canyon. And I think that, you really got that sense where you like hear it first before you see it. So it was an amazing shot. But yeah, roaming the countryside, torching goats. So.
Well, Jonah Robinson, I am a huge fan of Game of Thrones, the show, as I know you are. But wouldn't it be awesome if we could play a game of Game of Thrones?
Well, yes, it would.
Do you see what I did there?
I do. I'm with you.
Because there are games based on Game of Thrones, including a Game of Thrones living card game and the Game of Thrones card game HBO edition and a Game of Thrones board game. Tons of games of Game of Thrones. And if only there was a place, a cool site where you could buy these things. There is. It's called rollforcrit.com. That's rollforcrit.com. Rollforcrit.com. What does roll for crit mean? Well, there's two definitions you might find in a dictionary. Number one, to roll a die, often 20-sided, and hope for the best possible result, to take a chance, to bet it all, to win or go home, to dream the impossible dream, in short, to live. I mean truly, really live. That's the first definition. Definition two, an online store started by two overly enthusiastic board game lovers. Through daily news updates, video podcasts, and super low prices, Roll for Crit is a celebration of tabletop gaming. Our aim is not just to be the best place to buy games online, but also to be the best place to learn, read, and talk about games. We want you to have a good time. We also have a Twitter account, at Roll for Crit. That's R-O-L-L-F-O-R-C-R-I-T. A Facebook page, facebook.com/RollForCrit. And YouTube, at youtube.com/RollForCritCast. Try saying that five times fast. So the site is live now. They recently launched at RollForCrit.com. They sell many different kinds of tabletop board games, specializing in modern games like Battlestar Galactica, Arkham Horror, Android Netrunner, Munchkin, Seven Wonders, and classic games like Monopoly and Scrabble. So, Jonah Robinson, let me ask you this question. Do you ever play any board games?
I did. I just played one the other night. I played Balderdash, which is like an oldie but a goodie that I hadn't played in a long time. But I usually don't get too involved in these because Dave is like a much better spokesperson. But I will say, very much from the heart, I love tabletop games, and this is like my Luddite side coming out. I feel like we get too drawn into our devices, and there's something to be said for putting your phone away, putting your tablet away, getting out a tabletop game, and playing something as friends. I think, some of my best memories are doing that. So I'm going to sound like your grandmother and tell you that you should play Monopoly more. So.
Remind me not to invite you to my game of Scrabble on Wednesday nights that's played only with iPads, Joanna.
Yeah, I don't want to come, so fine.
But I'm a huge fan of board games as well. I just got this game, Ticket to Ride, recently. That's an awesome game. I enjoy the occasional strategic board game. So if you are also a fan of strategic board games and other board games, including Game of Thrones board games, check out our Kickstarter sponsor for this week, RollForCrit.com. We also got to thank all the people who donated to A Cast of Kings at the rate of $10. Thank you, guys. Connell Logan, Emma Glacier, Oscar Rowena, Rowan and Jen from Queensland, Australia, Tom Green, Lawrence Agleton, Charlie Price, Bill McCarthy, Sean Hillary from Baltimore, Maryland, Jens Lundbu, Casper Ostergaard Christensen, and Chris Pederick. Oh, wait.
Sorry.
I'm supposed to leave that one to you, Joanna.
I'm sorry. I will also thank Chris Pederick, Bob Wise, Jim Nardarkea. Yeah? Eva Chung, Tim Sexton, Christopher S., Jackson Vo, Peter Baravesh, there you go, Zach Fannin, Patrick Posta, Michael Young in San Jose, Che Wilkinson, and Jonathan Carpenter. This was not my best week, guys. Sorry about that.
I also have to thank Eva Chung as well.
I have to thank Charlie Price. We flipped the names this week.
We flipped
guys,
the names. That was my bad.
Yeah.
My bad, Jenna Robinson.
Pretend we read in the opposite.
Read the opposite, and that I gave a heartfelt thanks to Eva Chung for this Kickstarter contribution.
Who's bomb. We like her.
Because, she's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So on that note, let's move on. We only have like one other really main plot line here, right? There's an awesome scene at the small council where they kind of, I think we should just skip over these, Joanna, because I think we addressed these in the Brian Cogman interview. Is there anything you want to say about the small council scene and the Oberyn and Varys scene?
I definitely think we addressed the Oberyn and Varys scene very well. With the small council, I just wanted to address something that you sort of said as an aside. In the Brian Cogman interview, which is that, Mace Tyrell, I think, is definitely supposed to be comic relief in this. And I thought he was amazing and so funny when he was talking about, like, being masters of ships and scurrying off to fetch Tywin's parchment for
him. I like how respectfully Tywin treats him, right? Which is...
like, get my parchment for me.
Yeah.
But he was so pleased to do it. It was so great. And then Oberyn,
he wasn't like insulted at all.
No, he like had his nose in the air, like, oh, that's right, he asked me. and Oberyn was just being a bamf and just sort of thinking about what I thought about this episode was all the various iterations of the Small Council we've seen since the beginning of the show.
Right.
You know, remember when Littlefinger was on? Remember when Tyrion was on? You know,
remember when Ned was running things? Yeah, good times.
Good times. All right. But Varys has been the constant, right? Varys.
Yeah.
All right.
Then we come to the final scene, the trial, right, with Tyrion and Tywin and the other judges and all the people. They're all just there. They refitted that throne room so it could be a courtroom, I guess. Is it happened in the books too, Jonah Robinson, or is it like a separate courtroom in the books?
No, I believe it's in the throne room in the books.
Interesting. Cool. So
I'm not gonna bet my life on it, but I'm pretty sure.
So they all gather here, and apparently Westeros law, like, it feels like the way justice functions is a little bit different than modern. Like, I guess, can you, Joanna Robinson, articulate some of the main differences? Because I can take a stab at it, but I'd only be guessing.
Well, you don't have a lawyer or a barrister, I guess.
There you go. That's a big one.
That is just the crown calling witnesses. And then, but Tyrion could have called witnesses, but no one would testify for him.
Right.
So it's not, it wouldn't be as one-sided if the trial itself weren't as rigged.
Right, right.
And so I imagine that if he had had witnesses for his side, he could have asked questions to make it a little more even. I guess we just hear a bunch of testimony from the crown side of the case, and including that masterful performance by Cersei, and then judgment is handed down. So by the three judges, Tommen recused himself. That was a weird thing. That's not in the book. I think it just has to do with Tommen being older, so it being a little weirder that Tywin is sitting on the Iron Throne. Yeah, maybe it's not in the throne room because maybe they just wanted to have Charles Dance sitting on the Iron Throne because it was a great visual. So.
Yeah, because it looks pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
So Tommen doesn't recuse himself? I guess he's too young in the books, right?
He's a child, yeah.
Right.
And it all happens, it's in like slightly different order, so yeah.
So this scene was already pretty good. Like, it was, pretty solid Game of Thrones stuff where Tyrion's getting really frustrated and kind of like acting out and being funny and stuff, and it was already pretty good. But then they bring in Shay, who is not someone who I think anyone, like, I certainly didn't expect to see her. I'm guessing you probably saw it coming.
Yeah.
I should hope so.
Smugly, I did, yes.
Yeah. But I did have a holy crap moment when we saw her, because last we heard, she was
on a ship somewhere.
Being shipped far away. Now, we don't know why she participated in this ruse. There are some theories out there. I think one of the theories, I think we got an email about this, Shauna, was that Shay was actually trying to help Tyrion, right? That maybe Tywin and Shay had negotiated some deal that, if Shay came and testified that, it would be, he would guarantee that Tyrion would live. I highly doubt that theory, but it's out there, and I'm guessing you're just being silent because you don't want to give anything away. Is that right?
Well, yeah, and also I think Shay, TV show Shay and book Shay have always been different characters. While there's some spoilery stuff that I could bring up, I guess the big question that we've always grappled with is, does Shay actually care about Tyrion?
Right.
Was Shay so wounded by that, like, throwing the rocks at the puppy scene that we saw of Tyrion telling her to leave, that this is just righteous anger? She seemed genuinely kind of upset to be there. Was she paid? Was she, I'm not confident that they would go with the same motivations that we would see from book Shay. So.
Yep. Yep. Brian Cogman already explained that they added the scene with Jaime and Tywin. What did you think of that scene?
Interesting. He also talked about, he alluded to sort of all the problematic Jaime hero stuff, but if, and I think my favorite takeaway, not to just keep referencing this other podcast that hopefully most of you have already listened to, but my favorite takeaway from that podcast was this idea of, I'm not here to be your favorite character. So people who felt that betrayed by Jaime, and this is their favorite character, and how dare the show, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're still in that state of mind, then you have to acknowledge the scenes that are added that make your favorite character look better, if you are going to get so mad about the scenes that are added that make your favorite character look worse. So this scene where he pleads for his brother, you know, that's a net positive for Jamie's character, right? That he sacrifices what we saw him say in the first episode this season, which is, I'm never going to go to Casterly Rock. I do not want to be, you know, the next in line, all this sort of stuff. And he's going to sacrifice that to save his brother. The real question that I think we need to ask about that scene, though, is Charles Dance, how he played Tywin. It was this Tywin's endgame. Like, Tywin seemed like, I knew you were going to come to me with this counter proposition. It's a, you played right into my hands, basically.
Well, so the question, right, the question is about whether, you know, Tywin actually believes Tyrion is guilty. Because we know Tywin to be a pretty smart guy.
Right.
And we also know that anyone who has even half a brain, who knows about what's going on, like knows Tyrion, probably believes that he didn't kill Joffrey, right? I mean, just on a surface level, if you know about how smart Tyrion is, you wouldn't assume he would do something that dumb. But maybe I'm assuming too much, Joanna, and tell me if I am. But I guess...
No, I mean, I think that's a good assessment, but there's also the deep prejudice that the show hasn't explored as much, as harshly as the book does, of, you know, which it does bring up in Tyrion's speech of his status as a dwarf and what that means, what the natural prejudice is from these characters against him, and how Tywin, for whatever reason, holds his wife's death against Tyrion because Tyrion killed her when she came out, or this notion that you know, Tyrion married a whore and that brought shame on the family. I'm talking about his first wife, not Sansa. You know, like all this stuff. We've seen a lot of anger from Tywin towards Tyrion, tied up in family honor. So even if he's definitely too smart to believe that Tyrion did this, but maybe shaded by his own anger or prejudice, possibly.
Possibly. Or possibly he doesn't believe any of that crock, and he's just doing it. He's just saying all that stuff because he wants to ensnare Jaime in his plot.
Right, and right? Get and dispose of Tyrion, which is what he wants to. Like, you know, send him to the wall, which is the negotiation he makes, right?
Constantinos wrote in from Oxfordshire in the UK, and he said, I was wondering what you thought of Tywin's speech to Jaime where he says, you will father children named Lannister. To me, this implies he knows deep down about Jaime and Cersei's affair and the true parentage of the so-called Baratheon children. I'm not sure this was ever made clear in the books, end quote.
Yeah, and I don't think it's the first indication we've gotten that show Tywin is hip to what's going on between Cersei and Jaime.
Right.
Show Tywin, I got a tweet about this, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who sent it, but I really agree that both show Tywin and show Oberyn have been expanded in such real, you know, and Varys, I mean, the list goes on and on, of book characters that have been expanded beautifully in the show, both by performance and writing, and Tywin is one of them. You know, so he's just sort of this less nuanced, overbearing father figure in the books, and right. In this, he's so much more interesting.
Yeah, he's like a really rich character, one of the best in the show.
Yeah.
So anyway, whether he actually believes that Tyrion is guilty, we'll never know, probably. But it is kind of, I certainly think it's ambiguous at the very least, right? It's not.
I'd say so. Yeah.
Yeah. So then they, you know, they bring in Shay, and what I love about this scene is, how Peter Dinklage plays it, right? Because we pretty much never see him as defeated as he is in this scene. Like, I don't recall ever seeing him that defeated, because even when things are going down for him, even when he's like almost been killed, when everyone around him wants to kill him, he has some level of control over things, right? Like he always has like a backup plan, or he always knows what's going on. He kind of like has some control over the situation. And this scene, this episode, he just like completely lost that when Shay comes in, starts revealing all these true things that happened, but in a different context, right? That's the hardest part, is that they weren't just outright lies, that they were things that actually happened, but couched in ways that would be really hurtful to Tyrion.
Yeah, and so, such intimate things.
Yeah, and he just looks so completely defeated by them, and so like in such despair over it.
Yeah, and I think you're right in that even at his lowest moments, he's always had his wit his yep. sense of humor, that defense, you know, because that's his defense, right, yep. is his wit. And his defenses are completely down. So we see him go from devastated to enraged in a way that we haven't seen from him yet. So I was yeah. really – I mean, as you can imagine, knowing, you know – knowing as all of us who watch the show do that Peter Dinklage is so fantastic, and knowing that this scene was coming and the speech is almost word for word from the book, I was really excited for this trial, for this scene, for this performance. And I don't think it disappointed in any way.
Yeah, it was spectacular. Yeah. I mean, as we pointed out in our Brian Cogman interview, it's like one of the great courtroom scenes now, yeah. I think. So... spectacular work. The only other thing I want to point out about it is awesome reaction shots from people in the audience, specifically the Tyrells, when they're like outlining all the horrible things these people have done. That was amazing. Shay's motivation remained a big question. I don't think we'll... I mean, we're certainly not going to find out until next week. I don't think it's clear what they are from mm-hmm. this episode. And I am very curious, like, what's going to happen, you know? Because Tyrion has basically erased, has laid waste to Jaime's, like, hopes.
Deal, right?
It's like, he has eliminated any chance that, like, he's either going to go free or he's going to die. Is that right? Whereas the Castle Black was a middle ground.
Right.
So...
yeah, so either, so trial by combat, you know, the theory is... you know, we've seen it before in the show with Bronn and at the Eyrie and the Moon Door and all of that. But the theory is you put your life in the hand of the gods. And if you're not fighting for yourself, but your champion dies, then you die because the gods have decided your fate.
So. Right. Totally badass moment to end this episode on, I should say.
Uh-huh.
So anything else you want to say about this final scene, Joanna, before we close off?
No, I just like now that I know what's coming next week, the rest of, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, right? 4 more episodes. It's all clear to me how it's going to pan out, and it's so exciting. Like, no, I don't mean that in a smug – I really don't mean that in a smug book reader way. I just mean there's so much left for them to do. This really is a great book. Book 3 of – I wrote this post today in Vanity Fair sort of maligning some of the later books. But book 3, A Storm of Swords, has so much in it, and they still have so much left to do. So it's just going to be like this great for the rest of the season. Like we had I would say maybe episode 4. Like we had some slow – episodes, you know, in a row, but like it's just gonna be bam 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 for the rest of the season, so I'm excited.
Excellent. I was a huge overall I thought this was a great episode. Almost no like wrong notes at all. The only thing I was a little bit disappointed by was that the Yara plotline was a little bit anticlimactic, but other than that, fantastic episode, man. Really a huge fan.
Yeah, and I'm not gonna disagree. I mean, it was sort of like what is happening with the Yara thing.
Yeah,
but I like, if you want an explanation, I really do like what Brian Cogman had to say. Let's just consider it bonus material for the episode.
There you go.
And he forgot his own Twitter handle. So it's @B_Cogman. If you're listening to this as part two of that, that's his Twitter handle.
Yeah. All right. Check it out. So... we got a couple emails we got to go through real quick, Jonah Robinson. One of them is about so we got a ton of emails at acastofkings@gmail.com correcting us. Basically, we were a little bit confused about why Cersei was being so nice to Margaery, right? And a lot of people said, well, Cersei was nice to 3 people last episode, and they were all judges on the Tyrion's sort of...
or Margaery's the daughter of a judge, yeah.
Right. Tyrion's, they're all judges for Tyrion's trial.
Right. And I got why she's being nice to Oberyn, and I got why she's being nice to Tywin. I just did not put the pieces together with Mace and Margaery, and for that I feel very stupid. So thank you, listeners, for being gentle with your feedback.
They were so, so gentle.
They were pretty gentle.
So, most of the, 90% of them were gentle.
Yeah.
And then some of them weren't. That's probably the reason why Cersei was being nice to Margaery. She wanted to cozy up to Margaery's father, who, wanted to do him a solid, basically.
I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. I'll make your daughter queen, you kill my brother. It's that old saw, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. We got this email coming in from, who wrote this? This person didn't even leave their name, right? Actually, now I don't even know if I should read this email because they didn't leave their name. But I will point out that, okay, whoever wrote this, please let us know what your name is. It looks like their last name is Carson. Not sure if that's correct. But they wrote in, and I just had to read this because I thought it was awesome, even though it had what I would call a whiff of dickishness. This person writes in, quote, David doesn't make a big deal of it, but he keeps pointing out how they use real-world units of measure in this fictional medieval land. Fair enough, it is noticeable. However, he always mentions it in an almost snide wink to the writers, like he's all-knowing but all-forgiving of this, their minor transgression. He's too smart to let it escape his notice, but his beneficence is such that he will deign to suspend his disbelief. What's worse is that the latest mention of it was in the context of explaining how Westeros is not medieval Earth, but an alternate universe. In much the same way, I think he's forgetting the fact that these folks aren't speaking English. They're speaking common, and we are watching it from a common-speaking point of view. Perhaps he's been spoiled by the Battlestar Galacticas of the world, where we speed along someone's dialogue, and suddenly they throw us a, I'll meet you in 15 centons into the mix. Whoa, you go, writers. It's not English. It's another language in a galaxy far, far away. You just blew my mind, dude. But I contend that that approach is more flawed. It suggests that the folks are indeed speaking English, and if we were to suddenly materialize into that world, we'd understand everything but their units of measure. On the Game of Thrones, it should make sense that the units they discuss are the ones that we understand. It's not that they happen to speak English, it's that we happen to understand common. Or if you'd prefer, it's as if we were wearing universal translators. So when someone says, the wall is 700 feet high in common, we're able to understand the sentiment of the entire statement, and not a collection of the vocabulary words that happen to exist in translation. If you were a common to English interpreter, and some Westerosi said, Targuna Ponsanzu Gabagool, what good would it do to translate that into the wall is 18 gabagools high? Not too much. It's a good thing we all speak common. P.S. Apologies to David. I know this comes across as more denigrating than it has to be, but it's too much fun to take jabs at him, and that seems to be in keeping with the spirit of the show. End quote. I like how the spirit of the show is people making fun of me, John Robinson.
Is it? I didn't know that.
Apparently it is. So, this email, awesome email, and I guess what I would say in response to this email is what you interpret as kind of snide winking and condescension, it's just me kind of having fun with this idea that, with this whole idea that we are seeing this fictional medieval-esque universe. Where people like speak English, or we understand what they're saying, and that it's the same unit as our universe. I just think that is inherently like an amusing concept. Because come on, like, where is this alternate universe? Like, these people just evolved to look like humanoids. You know what I mean? Like, are they actually humans? Is this planet Earth? Like, there's just so many questions that you, like, if you go down that rabbit hole, there's so many questions. And I just like thinking about the tensions that it creates. It's like, you know, in those episodes of like Star Trek or whatever, where the people could pass through walls, but then their feet never passed through anything. Like, they would stand, like, you know what I mean? Like, so there's all these things that we forgive when we're trying to accept a fictional premise or a fantastical premise. And it's just fun to think about, like, where do we draw the line of what is too far to accept? Do you know? So, that's my response, is that you're right to take the piss out of me, but it's not really like, oh, I think these writers are kind of not doing it right. It's just kind of like, I think there's a lot of, I guess it's just kind of interesting to think about like where that line is. Does that make sense, Jonah Robinson?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's interesting and fun for you, and this is at least 50% your podcast, so definitely, but it's not fun or interesting for everyone, so but this is your platform, exactly, right? To
are you trying to say that you don't find that question interesting? I guess
it's not that I don't find it, I do find it interesting, I just feel like sometimes it can detract from a different conversation I'd rather have.
All right, that's a fair point. Which was there something specific, or were you just saying that generally?
Oh, I'm just saying that in general. I mean, just the nature, and you guys, you and I have talked about this before in reference to other medium, which is just sort of getting absorbed
into the minutiae.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Fair enough. I shall take that feedback, John Robinson.
But I'm not saying you shouldn't. Like, I would never tell you not to do it, just because, like you would never tell me not to talk about, like, all my weird ideas that I have about the nature of adaptation or whatever, like the things that I like to talk about,
right,
because that's what we're here for.
We
so
just
I'm not saying don't talk about it. I'm just saying, yeah.
Makes sense. I mean, we have things that we have, I guess, like, hearing your response, I think the takeaway is we have bizarrely specific things that we're interested in.
Right.
And this podcast is a way for us to work those things out.
Right.
So
someone called me an extremist feminist the other day for my work on here, which is hilarious.
That's
please,
amazing.
Please step outside and meet the rest of the world if you think that I'm an extremist feminist. But.
And on that note, where can we find more of your work on the internet, Jonna?
You can find all of my extremist feminist ramblings on Twitter.
So extreme.
On Twitter at Joe Wrote This, or you can find me every day on VanityFair.com.
You can find me at twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, at DaveChen.net, and find the other podcasts I do at /filmcast.com. Thank you guys for listening to A Cast of Kings. We'll see you next week.